Hello and welcome back. My name is Avi Heller and together we are learning Masechet Megillah. We find ourselves on Daf Yud Aleph Amud Aleph. We are on 11a and we are about halfway down the page. The best way to find it is it's right opposite where it says Hagot Hagra, just right in the middle of the page. And we have a confusing beginning. What we've been talking about up until now are the introductions to the classes or the sermons that the Amoraim, that the sages of the Talmud, would give to the Megillah. They would each introduce a verse of Tanakh, and then they would use that verse of Tanakh and connect it to the Purim story, and then they would begin their elucidation of the Purim story. So we did all of those. We did about 18 of them. And now we're going to start the Gemara's introduction, and now we're going to start the Gemara's darshaning, the elucidation of the Megillah itself. So there's a confusing thing because for some reason, or by a scribal error, the first piece of it got detached. So even though we are going to be starting right on the second word of the line where it says Achashverosh, you'll see that as we go through the Megillah, we darshan every word. And you'll notice that we're missing the first two words, Vayihi Bimei. So you might be wondering, where is the drasha of Vayihi Bimei? And the answer is that it is a couple lines up. So you have to go to 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 13 lines down from the wide lines, where it says Vayihi Bimei Achashverosh at the end of the line. That is the beginning of the Gemara's elucidation of the Megillah. So it quotes Vayihi Bimei Achashverosh, and it says, Amar Rav, Rav says, how do we understand the word Vayihi? We understand it as a combination word of Vay, as in Oy Vay, or Oy Vay, and He, which is Hey Yud, which is a kind of a keening, a mourning sound. It's the word Nehi, which means a lament or a complaint about something terrible that happened. So Vayihi doesn't mean and it was, which is its literal translation, but it means Oy Vey and Nehi Vekina. Terrible things are about to happen. Now we learned this earlier. On the previous daf, we had a teaching that said that every time it says Vayihi, it introduces a Lashon Tsar. It is the language of pain. And this is explaining why it is. The drasha is that it's Oy Vay and He. And then we modified it to say that it's only when it says Vayihi Bimei. So we should understand that what Rav here means is that when it says Vayihi Bimei, that when there is Oy Vay in the days of Achashverosh, it means that bad things are happening to the Jews. So that first drasha is way up there, and it gets accidentally placed there even though it's in the wrong place. It should be moved, according to the Gra, right to our spot. So we just read that, Vayihi Bimei Achashverosh, Amar Rav Vayihi, is what it says. Then we go back down to where we were, right across from Hagos Agra, where it says Achashverosh, which is, we've now darshan Vayihi Bimei. We know that that introduces something terrible that's about to happen. And the next word in the Megillah is Achashverosh. So the Gemara is going to give four interpretations for what the name Achashverosh means. And the assumption of the Gemara here is that Achashverosh is not his real name. Now, this is an assumption that holds across the board for the names of the Megillah. The Gemara has a certain assumption that Esther's real name was Hadassah, as it says in the Megillah, but that Mordechai had a real name, it wasn't Mordechai, that Achashverosh's real name wasn't Achashverosh, Haman, Vashti, all these are sort of like stage names. Now, it's not necessarily true. The name Achashverosh, especially if it's spelled a little differently as it is in the end of the Megillah, looks a lot like Chashyarsh, which is the Hebrew version of Xerxes. And according to many authorities, Achashverosh was the Persian king Xerxes I. Although there's no absolute identification of who he is, but it could be that that was actually his real name and he was the Persian king Xerxes. But the Gemara assumes here that it is a name that should be darshaned. So the first way that it darshans it is based on the word ach, which means brother. So Amar Rav, Achiv Shel Rosh, he was the brother of a Rosh, so he was Ach Shel Rosh, that's what Achashverosh means. Uben Gilo Shel Rosh, and he was the same age as a Rosh. Now, who is the Rosh? The Gemara will explain. Achiv Shel Rosh, he is the brother of the Rosh. Achiv Shel Nebuchadnezzar, he's the brother of Nebuchadnezzar. Now, interestingly, it doesn't actually mean this objectively. Biologically, the rabbis understood that Vashti was Nebuchadnezzar's granddaughter. Here it doesn't mean biologically. As Rashi explains, it just means that he was a brother in the sense that sometimes brothers look alike or act alike. And sometimes they don't, but sometimes they have a family resemblance. And what we're saying is that Achashverosh seemed a lot like Nebuchadnezzar. Shenikra Rosh, Nebuchadnezzar himself was called the Rosh, the head. Shenemar, as it says in the second chapter of Daniel, and this quotation is not exactly right, it's a kind of a paraphrase, but Daniel is interpreting Nebuchadnezzar's dream, and Nebuchadnezzar had dreamt of a statue that had a golden head, and he tells him, Antu Resha Didahava. In the actual pasuk, it says Didahav Tov, that the statue was made of pure gold. He tells him, you are the statue with the head of pure gold. So we know that that Nebuchadnezzar is the Rosh, and Ahasuerus is the brother of the Rosh. He's similar to the Rosh. Now, I think the Gemara is also insulting him and saying that he's kind of a cheap knockoff. He's like an imitator of Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar was a really bad guy. Ahasuerus was just a pretender. And he also says, Ben Gilo Shel Rosh, who he was also the same age as the Rosh. And I think this means like a contemporary of Nebuchadnezzar, even though he's a generation later. But the Gemara is going to explain. Hu harag, Nebuchadnezzar killed people. He killed many, many Jews when he destroyed the Beit HaMikdash and he besieged Jerusalem. Ahasuerus, who bekeish la'rog, Ahasuerus tried to kill the Jews, he just failed. Hu hechriv, Nebuchadnezzar destroyed the Beit HaMikdash. Hu bekeish la'hechriv, and Ahasuerus tried to destroy the temple. So whatever Nebuchadnezzar did, Ahasuerus tried to do the same thing but failed. Shenemar, as it says, and this is in the fourth chapter of Ezra, it says, Uvamalchut Ahasuerus, in the kingdom of Ahasuerus, Bitchilat Malchuto, in the beginning of his reign, Katvu Sitna, he wrote a cease and desist order. It comes from the word Lissatan, which means to obstruct. So it is an order of obstruction. Al Yoshvei Yehudav Yushalayim, on the residents of Judah and Jerusalem. In other words, what happened is that they were trying to build the Beit HaMikdash. At that point, this was after the Cyrus proclamation had allowed, and Cyrus was a king who was previous to Ahasuerus, had allowed the Jewish people to build the Beit HaMikdash, and they were trying to rebuild Jerusalem and the Beit HaMikdash, and Ahasuerus sent a letter saying, you have to stop building it. So even though he didn't destroy it, he sort of stopped it from being built. It is kind of problematic that it's at the beginning of his reign. As we'll see in the next daf, it seems like he wrote this letter more towards the end of his reign. But in any event, he was he wasn't a friend to the Jews exactly. Even after he allowed Mordechai and Esther to save the Jewish people, and even though Mordechai was his consigliere, he nonetheless wrote a letter stopping the work on the Jerusalem embassy, not the embassy, the Beit HaMikdash. I was just kidding. Okay. So that's the first interpretation, is that he was the Ach Shel Rosh. He was kind of a cheap knockoff of Nebuchadnezzar. Ushmuel Amar. Shmuel gives a second interpretation. And he interprets it, Shehushcheru Pnehem Shel Yisrael, that he blackened the faces of the Jewish people, Biyamav, in his days, Kishulei Kdera, like the bottom of a pot. If you can imagine a cast iron pot that's always on the fire, and it gets blackened from all the soot and the flames, that's how what he did to the Jewish people. He put us through torture, turned our faces black. The Marsha says that he's taking the letters of Ahasuerus' name and changing them to Esh Shachor, black fire. You have to kind of rearrange the letters to get that, but that's how he's reading Ahasuerus' name. The third interpretation of Ahasuerus' name is Rabbi Yochanan, Amar. Kol Shezochro, anyone who mentions the name Ahasuerus, Amar, he'll say, Ach Lerosho. Now an Ach is like a sigh or a groan. So the Maharsha says you can interpret this in one of two ways. Either when you hear the name Ahasuerus, you slap your head and you're like, and you groan, because of how much suffering he caused the Jewish people. Or it means like an imprecation, like you're like a curse on Ahasuerus. You mention his name and you're like, Yimach Shemo, let his name be wiped out. You say, Ach, on his head. There should be groaning on his head. So either way, in that case, Ach Rosh means a groaning on a head. The fourth interpretation is Rabbi Chanina Amar, Shehakol Naasu Rashin Biyamav, that everyone became poor in his days. So instead of reading it as the others were reading it, as Rosh, meaning head, he reads it as Rash, which means a poor person, that the Jewish people became poor in his days. Shenemar, as it says, Vayasam HaMelech Achashverosh Mas. At the very end of the Megillah, it mentions that Achashverosh levied very heavy taxes on his citizenry. So even though the Jewish people were saved in his days, they were heavily, heavily taxed, and they all became poor. Here he seems to mean actually poor, as opposed to in our last recording, where we talked about the idea that the Jewish people were poor in terms of Torah and mitzvot in this era. Okay, so four interpretations of the name Achashverosh. So now we go on. It says, Vayhi bimei Achashverosh. Who Achashverosh? The next two words in the Megillah are that he is Achashverosh. He's the same Achashverosh. So why do we need to repeat Achashverosh? We just said it was in the days of Achashverosh. So the Gemara interprets this, Hu berish, this is a famous drasha, if you will, Hu berisho, Achashverosh was wicked, mitchilato v'ad sofo, from beginning to end. He never changed. You know, the Megillah is often a story of change. Esther changes a lot. The fortunes of the Jewish people turn upside down from one end to the other. But Achashverosh, that guy never changed. He was wicked in the beginning, he was wicked in the end. And even when he did bad things to the Jews, he was wicked. When he did good things for the Jews, he was wicked. It was all just about him all the time. And that's why it says, Hu Achashverosh. Now the Gemara is going to mention a few other cases where we have similar language. The language is Hu. Whenever it specifies about a name, Hu, he is, it means he doesn't change. He's the same guy as he always was. So he mentions here at the end of the genealogy of Esav, it says, Hu Esav, Avi Edom. And it, since it says, Hu Esav, they say, Hu Berisho Mitchilato V'ad Sofo. Same thing as Achashverosh. Esav was wicked from beginning to end. Esav never did tshuva, even at the end of his life. And even when his father died, and it says in the Torah that Yaakov and Esav came to bury their father, the same way that Yitzchak and Yishmael came to bury their father, and we said that Yishmael did tshuva, there's a long midrash in the story that Esav didn't want to let Yaakov be buried there in Ma'aron HaMachpelah. So he never did tshuva, he was wicked from beginning to end. Hu Datan v'Aviram, Datan and Aviram, who were complaining Jews among the people who came out of Mitzrayim. According to the rabbis, Datan was the one that Moshe saved from the Egyptian that was hitting him at the very beginning of the Exodus story. And then later on, he informed them into Paro, which had made Moshe have to run away from Egypt. And they were part of the rebellion of Korach later on. So Hu Datan v'Aviram, they were... He was Datan and he was Aviram. Hein Berishan mitchilatan v'ad sofan. They were wicked from beginning to end. And then the last one of these is Hu HaMelech Achaz. It mentions the king Achaz, Achazyahu. Hu Berisho mitchilato v'ad sofan. When it says Hu Achaz, he was wicked from beginning to end. So all four of those guys were wicked from beginning to the end. But it can work the other way too. We have a pasuk in Divrei Hayamim, which says Avram, Hu Avraham. Avram, that is Avraham. Now there's a slight change. There's two changes here. Avram does change to Avraham. So that's a slight difference. You could say that it's coming to show the difference between Avram and Avraham. On the other hand, you have both names. Like here we have Achashverosh, Hu Achashverosh. But we don't have that in Esav, and we don't have that in Datan and Aviram, and we don't have that in Achaz. It only says their name once. It says Hu Esav, but it doesn't say Esav Hu Esav. In any case, it says Avram hu Avraham, hu bitzidko. Not that he was wicked, the opposite. He was righteous. Mitchilato v'ad sofo. So the hu just says, you stayed the same. And the same thing with hu Aharon hu Moshe. He was Aaron and he was Moshe. Hein bitzidkan. They were righteous. Mitchilatan, from their beginning. V'ad sofan, until their end. And it's not just about wickedness and righteousness, but the next example shows that it can be about whatever your character was. So the pasuk in Shmuel says, "V'David hu hakatan." David, he was the little one. Now this has an additional difference. Not only does it not say "David hu David," it doesn't even say "hu David." It says "V'David hu." So it's a little bit different, but the Gemara takes it anyway. Hu bekatnuto, he was in his littleness. By littleness here, I think it means humility. Mitchilato v'ad sofo, he was humble from his beginning until his end. From the time that he was a humble, lowly shepherd boy, seventh son, until the time that he was the king of Israel, he remained humble. Kishem shebekatnuto, just like when he was really little, Hiktin atzmo etzel misha gadol mimenu batoram, he made himself little in front of one who was greater than him in Torah. This is referring to Mipi Boshet, according to the Marsha. Kach b'malchuto, so too, even when he became king, hiktin atzmo, he made himself humble, etzel mi shegadol mimenu b'chachma, next to someone who was greater than him in wisdom. According to the Marsha, this is referring to Achitofel. Okay. So now we finish that phrase. Now we go on to the next word. We've so far interpreted every word in the Megillah. Vayhi bimei Achashverosh, hu Achashverosh. The next word in the Gemara, in the Megillah, is Hamolech mehodu v'yad kush. So first the Gemara interprets the word Hamolech, who ruled. Amar Rav, Rav said, Shamalach me'atzmo, he ruled on his own recognizance. In other words, he did not come from an aristocratic family. He was an upstart ruler. He overthrew the monarchy. Amri la lishvach, some people say this to his credit as a compliment. V'amri la liganai, and some people say this as an insult. This is similar to the way we talk about Noach. Ela told Noach, Noach ish tzadik, tamima ya bedorotav. Was he more righteous in his generation or less righteous? Some people interpret it to his credit and some people to his discredit. Same thing here. Amri la lishvach, some people say it to his credit, delo have inish dechashav lamalka kavase, that there was no man, delo hava, there was not, inish, a man, dechashiv lamalka, that was worthy of the kingship, kavate, like him. So, you know, that hamulech means he was the one who was the ruler. No one else was like him. The amri la lignai, and some people say it to insult him, delo have chaze lamalchuta, that he was not fit to be a king. Umamona yetera hu di yahiv, and he gave a lot of money, vikam, and he ascended to the royalty. In other words, he got there by nefarious means and he was never really fit to rule. It's actually surprising to me that they even consider the possibility that it would be lishvach to his credit without just going immediately to the negative explanation, but they do. The next line in the Megillah, the next words, are mehodu v'yad kush, from hodu until kush. Now, the modern designations, hodu is India, and kush is Ethiopia. So you're spanning three continents. You're going all the way from India down through Asia Minor and Israel to Africa, all the way down to southern Africa in Ethiopia. So that was, in the ancient world, kind of like the size of the Ottoman Empire or the size of Alexander the Great's empire. That was considered to be like the whole world. So Rav and Shmuel have an argument about this. Chad Amar, one of them says, Hodu b'sof ha'olam, India is on one end of the world, v'kush b'sof ha'olam, and Ethiopia is on the other side of the world. V'chad Amar, Hodu v'kush gabe hadad dehavu, and one says, Hodu, India, and Kush, Ethiopia, were right next to each other. Now, obviously, if it's India and Ethiopia, they can't be right next to each other, so maybe he thinks they're different countries. But he says they were right next to each other. Gabi hadadi havukaimi, they were right next to each other. Kishem shamalach al Hodu v'Kush, just like he ruled over Hodu and Kush, kach malach misof haolam v'ad sofo. So he ruled from one end of the world into the other. Now, on the face of it, this drasha doesn't make any sense. It makes perfect sense according to the one who says that Hodu was on one side of the world and Kush was on the other. But if they were right next to each other, how do you learn the whole world from that? So I heard a great idea from Rabbi Shalom Rosner, who quoted someone, I don't remember who, I think it was the Rugachever, who said that this was a proof that the Gemara thinks that the world was round. Because if you put Hodu and Kush right next to each other and you draw the lines going the opposite way, they would meet on the far side of the world. In other words, in a round world, if you're right next to each other, you're actually at opposite ends of the world if you go around the globe in the other direction. So that was a cute idea. Kayote bedavar, similar to this, Ataomer, you could say, ki hu rodeh b'chol ever hanahar, that he ruled, lirdot means to kind of rule with an iron fist, in the whole other side of the river. This is a pasuk from Malachim. Mi tifsach v'ad Aza, from Tifsa until Gaza, he ruled. Rav and Shmuel have the same argument. Chad Amar tifsach b'sof ha'olam, v'Aza b'sof ha'olam. One says tifsach on one side of the world, and Aza is on the other side of the world, so it's the whole world. V'chad Amar tifsach v'Aza b'hadei hadadei havukaimei. And one says tifsach and Aza b'hadei hadadei, together, right next to each other, havukaimei, were located. Kishem Shamalach al Tifsach v'al Aza, just like he ruled over Tifsach and over Aza, which were right next to each other, Kach Malach al Kol Ha'olam, so he ruled over the whole world. So we have a similar teaching and a similar disagreement about how to understand the words from Rav and Shmuel. Now that we're starting to talk about the idea of ruling the whole world, we go on to the next verses, which seems to indicate the next couple of words in the Megillah seem to indicate what we mean by ruling over the whole world. He ruled from Hodu until Kush, which was Sheva v'Yasrim u'mea medina, 7 and 20 and 100 countries. So Ahasuerus's empire encompassed 127 provinces, and we're going to understand that 127 provinces is the whole world. Amar Rav Chisda. So Rav Chisda says, Bitchila, in the beginning, Malach al Sheva. In the beginning, he only ruled over 7 provinces. Vilabasov Malach al Esrim, and then later on, he conquered more, and he became the ruler over 20. Vilabasov, and later on, Malach al Mea, then he became the king over 100. This is a problem, because according to this teaching, it sounds like in the end, he only ruled over 100. Not 127, which is what it seems like from the Pasuk. I don't know how to solve that problem. Ela me'ata, but the Gemara asks a different question. If that's true, we have a lot of cases, and the Rishonim ask and the Achronim ask other questions. So like when it says that Sarah was 127, it says that she was 127, and it darshens it. But here he brings a different quotation. Ushnei chayei Amram, the years of the life of Amram, who was Moshe's father, Sheva u'shloshim u'me'achana, were 7 and 30 and 100. He was 137 years. My darashtabe, how are you going to learn that he was first 7 and then 30 and then 100? I mean, that is how they darshan the life of Sarah. But he says, shiny hacha, it's actually a little different. Dekra yiterahu, because this is an extra verse. We don't really need this verse. Michtich tiv, mehodu v'akush, since I already learned from Hodu until Kush, I know that he ruled the whole world. Why do I need to know? Sheva v'simumeyam mendina lamali. What do I need 127 provinces to teach me? Shmamina l'drasha. So I know that it's designed here. These extra words are meant to have extra drashas. And that's a general approach of the rabbis, is to say that whenever a word is not absolutely necessary for the simple understanding of the verse, it must be coming to teach an additional, or it must be open to having an additional drasha attached to it. We're going to stop there. Since we're talking about the idea that Ahasuerus ruled the whole world, the next section we're going to talk about which kings were rulers of the whole world and which kings were not. We'll pick up with that in our next recording. Have a wonderful day.